Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are tickling your ears thanks to oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last Saturday we finally beat an Eddie Howe side for the first time in 8 attempts as we dumped his Bournemouth side out of the FA Cup. We now welcome West Brom to the Amex in the next round. It was also not too bad a week for the women's team as they recorded their first Super League win on the road at Liverpool, and they were also drawn at home to Manchester United in the fourth round of the Women's FA Cup. However, the less said about their defeat at Man City on Thursday night, the better. They are in action again though this Sunday at Crawley with Everton, the visitors. Today we take on leaders Liverpool at the Amex, who put 5 past this here last season, and most of the media are predicting more of the same this time out. However, we ourselves are in decent form at the moment, and we very nearly came away from Anfield with a point in August. Can we upset the apple cart? Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to welcome back the Argus's Brian Owen, and we're also delighted to welcome back someone who isn't quite a raw virgin, but, Steve Gase, it's been quite some time since your last confession.
I think the last time I was in here, we were talking about Dean Hammond in League One.
Wow.
That was some time.
Yeah.
You had a good hairline then.
Yep.
The tide hadn't received.
And
quite
a bigger
so
waistline,
far.
A bigger to waistline. Be fair,
yeah,
though.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Looking so good, mate. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, Alan. Yeah, very good.
Welcome to the Raw.
Thank you.
In that case, seeing as it's been a long time, we're obviously talking with Dean Days here. Let's revisit. Tell us about your first Albion experience.
Okay, so first Albion experience was Fulham 1976, I believe. I was about 4. So right. Yeah. So really early days, I was standing on a crate in the chicken run, and we won 2-0. I missed both of the goals. My dad took me. He wasn't a big Brighton fan,
why did you go?
Well, I think he just wanted to get me into football, and he knew I liked it, and I got into it. I went quite a lot during the 70s, but the bug didn't really hit until 1985, I would say, was my first big season.
This was under Chris Catlin.
So yeah, I'm a big Catlin fan.
Yeah, but you didn't come to the show though, did you?
I didn't come to the show. I think it was on. Was it on a Tuesday?
It was a Wednesday.
A Wednesday. Yeah, I haven't even got an excuse, Sadie, to be honest.
And actually, that show with Chris Catlin and Andy Rollins will be putting out very soon.
I think so. Yeah. Once I've actually got round to editing and bought myself a new bleep machine.
it was a terrific night. Brian, welcome back.
Hi.
And how's your new year been so far?
Busy. Lots of football. A cup win. Obviously, January's going to get busier towards the end, you would have thought. But yeah.
We're going to talk to you about the transfer window and what that means for you in terms of what you have to do, and fact checking all these lovely rumours we keep seeing.
Checking,
yeah,
that's what it is. Checking, not necessarily facts, but checking.
But let's start with last Saturday then, and we finally beat Bournemouth. Yay! I was looking into this, and it's. Some people, I was looking on Soccer Base, and it looked like 17 games since we'd last beaten them or something stupid like that.
I don't know how many it was. I know I missed the one when I was on holiday when they won 2-0, I think 11 years ago, and there was some argument about a goal. Might have been Baz Savage and Dean Cox. Obviously, there was the Alex Ravel hat-trick at...
That was the last time we beat them.
But it sort of feels like almost like a different club, doesn't it? It was nice to go. I missed the 2-0 actually before Christmas. I quite enjoyed this one, going there, and some good... clinical performance, I suppose, making the most of what they created.
But I mean, Steve, I mean, the side we put out, there was 8 changes, but everyone in that team, apart from Steele and Goal, who was making his debut, of course, has played at least 3 times in the first team in the Premier League this season.
Yeah, it was a super strong team. I think if anything, you look at the 2 teams, and I think Keaton respected it more than Howe, to be honest. We were there on the terraces thinking, you know, we were confident we put in a good performance, as we did.
Mm. I mean, Brian, I mean, how do you view the FA Cup from your point of view, and the fact that, I mean, obviously, most teams made a minimum of 8 changes of the Premier League side. And, you know, it's a complicated... I cannot, for the life of me, work out why the likes of, like, Leicester, etc., don't put out a weakened side. I mean, they're not going to get relegated. They're not going to win the league.
Yeah.
I'll win something.
I was sitting on the bus on the way to the Amex 2 weeks ago, and I think Al was talking about Brighton in that context, you know, that it should be okay in the league, got a good squad, give it a go. And I was thinking, yeah, actually, the same applies to Bournemouth and more. So I guess the league, I mean, even for every place is £2 million, isn't it? I can see why it's a, but most squads now, they should be strong enough to have a good go in the cup. Okay, you will rest a few players, but it's worked well for Brighton in both rounds. It would be nice to have a good cup run. It was good to get that win. Last season, I remember Glenn Murray saying that when they were not winning for quite a long time at this time of year, the cup wins did make it feel not so bad. You know, they won at Middlesbrough, they won at home to Palace. It actually kept things could have been a bit more gloomy, the feel around the club, than it was. So it has that. But how good would it be to have a cup run?
And again, I mean, like you said, it breeds confidence. And when you look at a side like Huddersfield, who went out at Bristol City, who their side was ridiculously weak.
Well, it's about maintaining a winning form, a winning momentum. The thing is, if we'd gone out of the cup, then, you know, approaching today's game and obviously next week's game against Man U, it would have taken the wind out of their sails a little bit. So it's a confidence boost in one. Obviously, it has no relevance to the league. But if you can actually get, you know, the results ticking over, keep the scoreboard ticking over. Now, I know, obviously, you know, we're not got the Ashley Barnes 3 points for this, but what we do have is the continuation. We haven't lost since, you know, but there's a good chance we're going to get stuff today. Who knows? Well, no, everyone knows. But to not lose,
I don't
better
know.
Still to win.
I don't know.
Okay, fine. Yes. Yeah, we were having a look at the odds earlier today, but that's another matter entirely. So, yeah, it's a good confidence boosting thing. And like I say, we realise that probably the game against West Brom, totally winnable. You also get to realise that unless you're playing Man City or Chelsea or something like that, probably most cup draws are not that exciting unless you're playing one of the teams that maybe we did a Fans United for, or, you know, the third or fourth division sides, where the romance of the cup, where we're there to be knocked off our perch. I mean, it's not the most exciting cup draw, but once upon a time, go back 5-6 years, playing at home to West Brom would have been a reasonable, tie than it is now.
It's one that we were dreamed about a few years ago.
Absolutely.
But we're going to talk about the draw a little bit later on. But let's talk about the game itself. And like I said earlier, there was 8 changes to the team. Only Lucardia Duffy and Stevens retained their places, and there was a debut for Jason Steele. So what did we make of Jason's debut?
I mean, I haven't seen him at all up until the Bournemouth game. I think the first thing that I would say, having been on the terraces, is the fans gave him a tremendous ovation, and I thought they were really supportive of him. They were cheering every time he touched the ball, singing his name, and I think that must have helped his confidence.
Do you think this was on the back of the grief that on social media that Sunderland fans gave, well, him and us?
Yeah, quite possibly. I think they probably realised it was a big game for him, and they did the same with Button, didn't they? Yeah, they were really good with Button, so I thought that was really good, and he had a good game. I mean, I'm guessing, and it is a total guess, that the reason he's at the club is quite similar to Ryan. He's quite diminutive. He doesn't command his box in the same way that Ryan basically allows Duffy and Dunk to do that. He basically looks to, you know, he doesn't come out and claim crosses. And I think Steele had a very similar performance, but he made a couple of really important saves in the second half. Couldn't do anything about the goal, unfortunately. Yeah.
There was an interview in another paper that's out today, which we won't mention that particular paper's name because it's horrible.
Anyway,
Duncan Duffy described themselves as dumb and dumber.
Well, the issue about, and we've had this conversation many times, and I think you convinced yourself that Matt Ryan was about 4'3" once upon a time.
No, 2 for nothing.
2 for nothing, are close enough, yeah. But the point is that it's such a key relationship between the two centre backs and the goalkeeper. Mm. And let's go back to, I think it was the Everton game. Cross came in, I think it was, no, it wasn't Everton, whatever the game was. It was a home game, the cross came in, and someone waved their leg at it, and Button spilt it. Yes. I know we're talking about Button's, and you get to realise it might have been some nerves on Button's part, but it's also probably about the nature of the communications. Mm. Let's go back to when Stockdale first came. Here, the relationship between him and Dunk at times could be mad. You know, the number of silly goals that we gave away because the communication was so poor. And then Ben Roberts came to the club and everything sort of seemed to change quite a lot. And David Stockdale had two of the greatest seasons we've ever seen from a Brighton goalkeeper.
Probably the greatest two in his career.
Especially
Burn now.
Absolutely. See, the relationship between those two, and so long as everyone knows their job and does it, then I don't think that having a relatively small goalkeeper that isn't the size of Shane Duffy isn't necessarily a major issue. It's about the communication as to who gets which ball and they deal with it appropriately.
Definitely. Matt Ryan will tell you that his height has never been mentioned until he came to England, as indeed a Belgian reporter I saw in his at Watford start last season, probably what's at the third game. He said he's just never mentioned, because he had a slightly shaky start to his first season, didn't he? He said, the bloke I was talking to works in Belgium said,
yeah,
I've never seen him make that sort of mistake. And I said, what about the height and crosses? And they said, never. What are you talking about? He had no clue. I mean, there was one at West Ham, wasn't, I don't even remember, where Button came and climbed above Andy Carroll and took it really well at the far post, and him and Duffy seemed to be on the same wavelength there.
Well, I want my goalkeepers to do that, to be honest. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of punching or leaving it to defenders. Come and clear it and make the ball safe.
But if there is an issue with that, and like I say, so long as everyone knows their job, then to be honest, it doesn't matter who clears it, as long as it gets cleared.
Well, I mean, I can't be critical of Matt Ryan. I mean, like I said, he got quite rightly, he got the Raw Player of 2018.
And there is no greater accolade.
Absolutely. there is none. In fact, I'm delighted that the club have stolen our thunder and done their 2018 goal, which is going to be judged today. And the one we chose, well, was the one at Stoke for Esquerdo, is quite a long way down the pecking order.
Oh, no,
but when you say steal, him and Duffy obviously have some rapport from their Blackburn days, as was seen after that sort of joint save they made late on last Saturday, and the hug that went on as the ball was sort of bouncing around the 6-yard box.
Yeah, I'd forgotten they played together. But we've also, speaking of Burns, we should mention that Dan Burn was on the bench for us as well. I didn't get on, but it was nice to see him finally at the club. Okay, well, the game could have been very, very different if the Cherries had actually taken the chance when they missed an open goal early on.
Yeah, Lise Moussa, from the Duffy block. Balogun mistake, wasn't it, earlier on?
Yeah.
Dived in sort of midway through the half. But looking back at some games, there's so often, you know, there's been so many games where even Pep Guardiola says, you know, games are decided what happens in the penalty area. And there's been so many where misses at Newcastle, at home to West Ham, they might not have won. Different home to Spurs if Knockhart had taken that chance. So sort of how it happens. And I heard a cry coming from the away and then of attack, 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 to sense that Brighton fans weren't overly pleased with how it had gone. Dale Stevens put the ball into the box and the rest is...
Well, let's talk about the goal. And it was a hopeful ball I've got written down here, which Steve Cook got his head onto, but Nicardi was able to turn it into the path of Anthony Knockhart, who fired home his second of the season. That pass back from Nicardi was wonderful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
From a Bournemouth point of view, you'd probably be sort of shaking your head, because one, that should have been dealt with the cross, but Nicardi was on his toes and then used his heel beautifully. Then there was the horrific sort of nutmeg. I don't know why I'm actually sort of like saying this from a Bournemouth point of view. It's brilliant that we scored, but if that was our goal we were conceding, we said, well, there's a touch of Keystone Cops about this. But, you know, still got to put it in there.
But Lucardi coming into that centre forwards berth, I mean, how he's done it, it's not the only time he's done it. Obviously, headed against the post later on, and he's done it on coming in off that.
He really can't head a ball.
No, but I mean, I like that movement. That although he says he's not a central striker, it's funny how he can then gravitate to be a central striker at certain times.
Well, I mean, I think that's giving us an option, though. I mean, obviously, he is coming in from that wide berth, and that's how he's getting his goals, pretty much.
Brian, I've got to ask you this. I mean, obviously, you're in touch with the people at the club quite a lot. What has happened in the past month or so that's turned Lucardia from a kind of a target for the Boo Boys into, you know, someone who's really appreciated now?
I think he was appreciated. We kept hearing bits and pieces that, you know, he's a good player, Lucardi, and what we see in training. I think Glenn Murray said something about he was a good player. Bruno came out after he missed that chance at Burnley and spoke about he did quite well. You know, it's a shame he missed that chance when it was his big chance. And I think then we all thought he'd hit rock bottom. But he said, but he played quite well. So I sort of picked him up on it in the driving rain and freezing cold as he wanted to get on the bus. I said, well, why did he play well? And he explained what he did tactically, what he offered, and the bits and pieces he did, knitting things together and that. And I said, is that why he... And we actually did a back page on it, why Lucardia can be a hit. Bruno explained. So I think they've always thought it's there. But it's the system, isn't it? I mean, it's so much so... Mm. He'll say it suits him so, but it almost... He makes it. He's the one who makes it work, because it's the same players, but a different system.
Is it injuries, though? Because, I mean, obviously, we've changed the style of play a little bit, and we're a lot more forward-thinking, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that Glenn's not so pivotal to us at the moment. But I mean, it's the fact
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, Glenn is still a target man, and Andoni is to a point. It's just that Andoni can offer the pace where Glenn can't. But apart from that, when Glenn's on versus when Andoni's on, I don't notice a huge difference in the setup.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is we've got injuries to we've had injuries to Jahan Bashir, Squierdo.
Yeah, the wingers been a bit short. Wingers.
Knockout's been out of form. So and putting Lacadia there, it seemed like. Initially, we thought it looked a bit like a sticking plaster for a bit, but it was actually his position that he played in Holland.
Well, just picking up on what Al said, that's what he said. Initially, he plays on the left of a front three, and I think we thought when he came in, that gives Chris Hughton will use that option. That's going to be an option we're going to see, and we didn't. But then, obviously, we haven't. I just think what he did at Burnley, there were bits there that people saw who know more about it than us. They didn't just see him head across over the bar. So,
but that's what people remember, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Brian, you're obviously closer to the club. Do you see this as a bit of a master plan, or you know, a longer term plan that's been in place for a while? I mean, you look at we signed 5 central midfielders. Mm. We've got 5 decent central midfielders now, if you include Grace in that. You know, we've got these players that can play in this 4-3-3 that we seem to have adopted. I just wonder whether it was a case of getting to the point where we were fairly safe and then transitioning.
I wouldn't be that close to know that, but I do sort of know that's the role that he prefers. That was what he was like. I was just a bit surprised we didn't see more of it, if you like. And so, but then things have been working, I suppose. But also Pascal Gross hasn't been quite as effective maybe in that number 10 spot. I think it's just opened things up a little bit. That's almost like V-shape with Stevens at the base. Proper's been getting forward more than what he has done. But then maybe they'll go back to work something else. But it's nice to see them using it. Dale Stevens says we've used this 4-3-3. We use it quite a lot. But it's they've used it in a progressive way at home of late, rather than a way of essentially getting a solid midfielder in instead of a number 10 as a defensive thing away from home.
Yeah. Okay, well,
it's just going to say, it's actually one of those weird things. When Chris Hughton joined us 4 years ago and someone asked him, what is your preferred formation? And he said a 4-3-3 with it. And yet he spent the first 2.5 years, the first 3 years, in fact, we got up on it, on the back of either a 4-4-2 or a 4-4-1-1. And we're thinking, okay, you prefer 4-3-3. But obviously what he was looking at was what he's got to work with.
Yeah.
And then dealing with it appropriately.
I'm pretty sure he said his preferred formation when he came was 4-5-1.
Well, we're kind of playing that. It depends on whether we got the ball or whether we don't have the ball. That's, I think, the main difference. But that was his, and it's taken him sort of 4 years to get there. And it's interesting he's doing it in the middle of our second year in the Premier League. I mean, that takes balls.
The other reason why I wonder whether maybe this has been a longer term thing is you look at the purchase of Bernardo, who would seem to really suit that system. I mean, he's a player that needs to bomb on, and you've seen the role that Gaetan Bong's done in the last kind of couple of years. You can't really do that in the rigid system that we've had in the past. And now suddenly Bernardo's in, and he seems the man, although I thought Bong was fantastic at Bournemouth. I thought it was one of his best games in a
OK, well, we're going to talk about Gaetan in that game in a minute, but let's talk about another one of our midfielders who scored his first goal for the club on Saturday, and that was, of course, Yves Bissouma.
Cunningly disguised as a bottle of tequila.
He was, I've got here, the busy knockout plays the ball inside to Bissouma, and the Mali international takes the ball on, cuts inside, and somehow finds the bottom corner. And I've got here, what was Boric doing?
He fell over a bit early, didn't he?
He was diving about halfway through that description you were giving. But no, fair play to Bissouma having a go. He's not shy, is he? So, he struck it well enough in the corner.
He
shot and it went in. That's all you need to know.
It's a player that, again, it's been well managed by Chris, isn't it? He's been in and out. I've been given a taste of it, and he's...
Well, the kind of weird thing is that he's been brought in with values and attributes that actually no one else has, but aren't that obvious as to how they're going to fit into Chris's plans, because he's a central midfielder and yet he goes on a little bit. If anything, I think the closest person he's to in terms of the most logical person for him to replace is Pascal Gross, plays the number 10 role. He's forward thinking. I mean, he carries the ball at a time where others would just take 2 or 3 touches and then pass it. He wants to bring, you know, and what his crossing's like, we don't know. But the fact is, he's a breath of fresh air at a time where sometimes our play could have been stultifying.
Mm. I believe there was an interview of Chris in a paper that Brian might work for this week. Which would be, of course, the Argus, where I think Chris said that Eve could possibly be the best player at the club. It could go on to be the best player at the club.
Possibly. I know Dale Stevens rates him very highly, doesn't he? And there was a lot of excitement when he came, he had that moment against Liverpool, which was a bit character built in, obviously up at Anfield. Mm. But in France, yeah, he's very, very highly regarded. And I keep thinking he's going to do something silly, but he doesn't. He's got that impetuous nature about him, but he doesn't, without maybe the downside of it. He's probably a bit more disciplined than he looks from his sort of carefree style.
Well, yeah, with one exception, and we're talking about the Palace penalty.
Yeah.
And then mucking about, and he just wanders up behind the referee and knocks the penalty ball off the spot. And of course, it winds them up. I mean, get a yellow card for it. But it was a real... There wasn't...
I have to ask you, what's a penalty ball?
I said from the penalty spot. kick the ball from the penalty spot. A penalty ball is something that Zaha is always thinking he's playing with.
I think one of the one of the indications of how confident Chris Hughton is in his ability was he threw him in really early. And we've got a real habit of bringing in players to the club and bedding them in for months before they get a game. Mm. But Basuma was in the side very early, wasn't he? I mean, but he looked like it was too
against
early.
Watford, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, and he played against Southampton away. Yeah. But he did look a bit out of his depth, I think.
But I mean, but that game at Watford, which was largely horrible. but when Basuma came on in that game, he was.
I think he did more in his first 30 seconds than, and I'm going to pick on him again, Pascal Gross had done in his 70 minutes. Don't get me wrong, the entire team was terrible, but he was just that one little spark. You think, oh, we've got something here.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, you mentioned Gaetan Bong there, and he was getting into some good positions, and his crossing ability was something which the cross for the chance that Lucardia put against the post.
It's incredible, isn't it? Because we've not really seen him in the opposition half in two seasons, really. And then suddenly the new system, the new shape. Bernard has been playing in that role, but he's been able to get forward. There was the cross for Lucardi's chance.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I believe in the second half, the cross for the Andone corner. Yeah, so Andone got battered by Boric, I think, didn't he? And then about the best thing Boric did all afternoon. Mm-hmm.
But Bournemouth went in 2-0 down at half time. They made changes. Brooks came on, and he looks a player, doesn't he? He's a pain in our side, a thorn in our side.
A pain in the backside, I think, is what you meant to say. But yeah, I mean, he scored two very good goals when we played him in the league, and we just didn't deal with him. But but he's also that kind of player who looks like he's just sort of got out of detention, or you're going to stamp on his, you know, Shane Duffy will stamp on his satchel. But yeah, I think he's destined for decent things, actually.
He's got a big future, hasn't he? Yeah. First time I've seen him live, and I couldn't stop raving about him on the way home. I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah. But it wasn't him that scored, of course. It was Mark Pugh, who always seems to score against us, actually.
Yeah.
It was...
And not a great deal the keeper could do about it. So any criticism or any sort of praise you want to heap on Steele.
Brian?
That was the one period then when it felt like a cup tie there. Fans got into it. Obviously, Brighton fans were into it all the way. And it actually felt like a proper...
They got the clappers
out.
It's
not a derby, but it felt like a derby. And it felt like a cup tie. But until there was that one that flashed across the goal mouth.
Yeah. And just for the sake, we would like to point out there are actually 19 clubs closer to Brighton than Bournemouth.
That's what I'm saying. It felt like a derby.
Including Wickham, Reading, Watford.
Wickham? Wow. Yeah.
And Southend is closer as well.
Just about, yeah.
It sort of felt like a proper match then for those 10 minutes until, like you say, that corner kick and Shane Duffy learning his lessons from 3 days earlier.
But again, Bong, as you mentioned there, whips in a dangerous cross which leaves Andone in a heap as he tries to get on the end of it. It's a corner. The corner is played towards Duffy at the far post, who heads it back across the goal and Andone gets his goal. Have we seen that before somewhere?
Do you think Liverpool have got spies watching us to try and work out what we're doing in training this week from corners?
I described it as Gareth Southgate's bus stop last week, but it was.
Well, we saw it at West Ham, and Duffy headed wide, and he said afterwards, "I should have headed that back across for somebody to turn in." So good to see that. I was sort of thinking of that as he headed that back in for Andone.
Yeah,
but another goal for Andone and another header.
Well, the other thing is that we've mentioned it on the show before. When you consider last year, and the ball would come in, and Duffy and Dunk would both win a header, and none of them could get it close to the goal. Yeah. And you get to realise, well, in that case, do the sensible thing of, I mean, and let's face it, there's not that many people bigger than Duffy in the division. So just head it back and then let the carnage begin in the goal mouth. And it worked even as far back as playing against Arsenal last year. It worked first time. So, you know, by all means, try and head it towards goal, but, you know, try not to stick it in Rose Ed first.
Well, if you can chest it down and do a dainty little flick with the outside of his right boot, all the better, or a one touch and pass into the bottom corner as against Man United.
Yeah.
And we do need to point out at this point that Shane Duffy has scored more goals than Zaha. But
he's scored more goals than everyone this season at our club except Murray.
Hasn't he got more assists than Zaha as well last year?
Probably. We'll look it up.
I think that's true.
We'll look it up, and if it's true, we'll smash it across social media.
But OK, well, it was there was a couple of great saves from Steele. One particularly at the end where he tipped it over from, I think it was from Cook's. Cook, yeah. Cook's header, wasn't it? So I mean, it was so we're in the hat for the next round. West Brom at home Saturday, 3 o'clock kickoff, which is exactly what we wanted.
Decent price tickets.
Yeah,
and I say I've got a 10-year-old who's delighted about that, especially £5 ticket for somebody to take, because I can't take him, obviously. So
how is your handiwork? I mean, are you good at making foil FA Cups? Have you ever even tried?
I bet he's good. He's good at art. He might. He's not that interested. He's sort of interested in football, though. So £5 to watch a game is good. A Premier League price is not good. So ideal.
Because I took my daughter Molly to the Coventry game last season. She was absolutely. We made a full FA Cup together, and I mentioned that we're at home in the FA Cup again. Oh, I can make another cup.
I'm definitely going to get my kids on that. Tommy's the creative one, but Oscar loves the football, so he'll take the cup.
Paul
for
Barber's
Tommy.
Missing out a trick here. Actually, the club could host an FA Cup foil workshop for kids, and you know they'll sting their parents for it. But
Molly wants to do a 3D one. I'm like, she's six. I didn't even know she knew what 3D is. In the draw then. So obviously we're at home to West Brom. There's quite a few All Premiership ties as well.
Don't care.
Well, basically I do.
Good
because
for the journey, isn't it?
It makes it. Yeah, it gets rid out. Of a few more.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously one of Arsenal, Man United are going out, which is good. One of Palace and Spurs are going out, which is...
Liverpool already gone.
Newcastle or Blackburn at home to Watford, so that'll be another one. Man City, Burnley, so Burnley are going out.
Lincoln have gone. Good news.
So it's, I'd like to see us go deep into the competition, at least to the semi-finals.
Well, the only way that Man City get knocked out is when they play Wigan.
This is true.
Three times in the last 6-7 years.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Anyway.
It's a good draw, isn't it? We can't count our chickens, but it's winnable at home.
It's winnable. It's £15 for most people. I hope they'll open up the whole stadium, certainly the North Stand.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to be a 6,000 crowd. It's going to be, I would guess, sort of upper teens, maybe low 20s.
Definitely. Is the North not open? I think that is open.
It's just the lower bowl at the moment. Which is 20,000 anyway.
And so I think they're doing the travel concessions as well.
They are.
Absolutely. It's worth considering if you're taking three or four people. It's worth
And £5 for a kid, as you mentioned earlier, that's a bargain.
It's almost free by the time you've got them there for some people with the travel.
Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Over 96,000 shirts on there now, and I'm just going to hand.
Frankly, it's about time we got to 100,000. So come on, people, buy a shirt, take a picture, stick it on Phil's website. All you have to do.
There's not an awful lot of mystery about this one this week, so I'm just going to pass it over to Brian to describe it for us. It's got. There's no photoshopping. It's just
it's classic. It's orange, white stripe down sort of one side, bordered by the sort of navy blue trimming, Admiral logo. Could imagine maybe Ricky Hill. Oh, collar.
Do you want to take a guess at what side it is?
I can imagine maybe Ricky Hill wearing that. Brian Steen, yeah. Brian Horton.
Yeah.
David Pleat not wearing it, but running on the pitch in his suit.
Mick Harford could punch someone in that.
If only there was a link to this shirt this week.
Is this the team who Nathan Jones mistakenly referred to as Brighton during his press conference when he was at Stoke? He was talking something about Luton. He actually said Brighton. Oh, sorry, I mean Luton. So
wow,
get
he's
in.
Got that. He's,
get in, Nathan. I mean,
was Nathan Jones wearing this when he received the League One Manager of the Month award yesterday? Did you hear about that?
No, he
was awarded the League One Manager of the Month award for obviously his work at Luton in a Stoke City shirt. Not the most
hashtag awkward.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, it's a lovely shirt though. Yeah. It's a proper old fashioned.
I'm also guessing that is. I don't think. I mean, Brian was mentioning the players from the 80s. I think it's early. I think that's a 70s shirt, isn't it?
This is correct. It is. I'll tell you. This is what Phil Shirley from oldfootballshirts.com has to say about this shirt this week. Obviously, you've all guessed it's Luton. That's no surprise there. Judging by the great big Luton badge on it that he hasn't photoshopped out.
Yeah, I didn't mention
that. This is the 1974 to 70. 1999 home shirt of Bedfordshire's finest, Luton Town, says Phil. This shirt marked a departure from the Hatters' traditional white kits worn since the 1920s. In 1974, a certain Eric Morecambe was a director at Luton, and he came up with the idea of switching to bright orange for their home shirt. As it happened, in the kit catalogue, there was one with a navy blue and white stripe, and so that one was chosen. After Eric's departure from the club, there was a move back to white shirts, but it was always with a bit or a lot of orange in them. And during the 1990s, there were some shockers. You can see them all at oldfootballshirts.com, says Phil. And then... you can see them all about on our site. And then back to the straight laced white kits until some bright spark in 2009 signed a deal with EasyJet, and the Hatters adopted bright orange for their home kit once more. Nathan Jones has of course just ended his tenure with Luton Town. It's such a shame, he's off to the land of anti-football, says Phil. I hope he's getting paid well to do it.
Well, the thing about Nathan's move is, I think we're actually, we consider Stoke this anti-football thing. Sorry, Andy Naylor, if you're listening, we don't care. But I think it's just what Tony Pulis sort of brought to the Premier League. And
traditionally, in the 70s, they were a good football inside. They were like, I'm trying to think, sort of a top six or seven side who played good football, weren't going to win anything and won one League Cup. But it was like a nice alternative to the big teams. Mm-hmm. But I actually used to come watch them occasionally myself because of family living up there. Right. And they did play.
Was that at the Victoria Ground?
Yeah, was. I like the Victoria Ground. I mean, when they moved to sort of... not so
to the wind tunnel.
But, I mean, also going back to Nathan Jones, I don't know if you heard, he happened to be in Brighton when he got the phone call.
He
said, I had a couple of days off, I was down in Brighton. He spoke about how similar all the good things that Brighton have got and how it'd be nice to, he sees, you know, the community things and fans and that, and he wants to see similar at Stoke. So there were so many Brighton connections in that press conference. It sort of showed that he was, A, he comes down here on his day off, B, he's still got a lot of time, and C, he wanted to talk about Luton, he actually said Brighton at the slip of the time.
But I mean, a lot of people, Steve, see Nathan as the heir apparent to Chris eventually.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I think it's a bit early, isn't it? I mean, he's only had 2.5 or 3 years as a manager, isn't it?
I don't think anyone's looking to offload Chris just yet.
No. He's got a lot of potential, isn't he? I mean, my one thing with this, I think it's a great move for him financially. I think it's not the best move at all, probably a terrible move in my eyes from a footballing perspective. I think Stoke are on the way down, if anything. They're a bit of a Sunderland for me at the moment. An ageing squad doesn't play the kind of football that Nathan Jones wants to play. And I'm worried he won't get the time. I really hope he does all right there, but I think he was doing brilliantly at Luton, and it was a great project.
Well, he does seem to be a manager with a plan, and he's not frightened to change it early. As well, it is.
Well, the point about it is that one of the things that Stoke City, their board were evidently expecting a bounce back straight back. So for them not to do so implies that there is an issue. Now, this is the thing that a lot of boards of directors do, is that they assume that because the team isn't playing well, it's all down to the manager, and it seems to zero in on the manager all the time with this notion that a manager is judged by his results. And actually, you've got to look at it needs to be looked at holistically. Are there bigger issues at Stoke City at play than a problematic manager? If Nathan Jones does really well, then he probably gets to realise the answer is yes, it was just the manager. But you can't necessarily assume that. So the fact that they've actually crashed and burned in the way that they are, and I'm a little bit surprised, to be honest, but the way that they've crashed and burned a little bit doesn't necessarily mean it was down to the manager alone. It's kind of agreeing with your point that Nathan Jones is one of two things. He's on a hiding to nothing, or he can do no wrong. But the board has to consider that maybe there are bigger issues at play than just the previous manager.
Well, you know, there's some big egos in their dressing room as well, and it's the case of whether they buy into what Nathan wants to do. And you know, I wish Stoke fans say who exactly,
you know, which well, is a,
lot of a
worry.
People, a lot of people, I mean, on Twitter and stuff, they had to Google him and things because I had no idea who he was, which made me laugh. But I mean, one thing I did point out, find on Twitter, which I thought was quite eye opening, was a tweet from Kemi Agustin. And he said, my time at Brighton wasn't good, but one of the positive things I got from that period was getting to know Nathan Jones. We had discussions, but he was always straightforward, and that's what I liked about him. Wishing him all the best at Stoke, he fully deserves it.
One word in there was positive, and that is one thing, one word you particularly associate, I think, with Nathan Jones and how he... I wasn't at that Boxing Day game against Reading, but how they somehow engineered a result out of that and a change of momentum and getting the crowd back, and obviously Fulham was quite memorable. He has got that. I think he's got he's taking Joaquin Gomez as well with him from the ex-Brighton coach, another link. And you'd think you'd put Bojan Krkić back in the side, which I think, according to the man who sits next to me at work, has been a bone of contention that he hasn't been playing. One of their most talented players.
I think one of the things that happened with the Reading game is it did help that Steve Clark took Glenn Murray off. You know, he scored either one or both goals, and then took him up. I'm thinking, great. You know, he was going to destroy us that day.
Okay, let's move on from there then. And it's a big game today, home to Liverpool. And there's one little boy. He's going to be a mascot today, isn't he, Al?
Yes, he is. I'm not sure how old he is. But
he's eight.
He's eight, is he? Okay, well, listen, Jamie Greed, have a great day. I'm not sure if you're going to be holding a Brighton player's hand or a Liverpool player's hand.
Well, quite frankly, if you're out on the pitch, make sure you nobble any of the opposition players.
Yes, as you go
players,
past shaking hands, stamp on Salah's foot, give someone a good kick.
Have one of those flowers that squirts people in their face or something.
Thing, absolutely. You know? Not that we're advocating violence or cheating or anything, and this is not the equivalent of ball tampering here, but you know your place. No, listen, Jamie, have yourself a great day. And enjoy it. So and good luck to you, mate.
Okay. Now, and also on our notice board this week, in less happy times, we lost Dan Woods this week.
Yes, Dan Woods was the guitarist in Attila the Stockbroker's band Barnstormer. And I don't think when John Attila decided that he wanted to make a song to help the Albion's funds for raising awareness for Falmer and what have you. I don't think his band particularly had a say in the matter, but. he got his band and he got Too Many Crooks together, and including actually Ralph Brown, the actor. He had a guest saxophone spot on this, and performed Tom Hark brackets We Want Falmer, because John always felt that it was actually Brighton's song because it was made popular by the Piranhas. Dan Woods was the guitarist in that band, and sadly he succumbed to a long battle to cancer this week. So I just want to say I met him a few times. There's a lot of people who knew him, loved him to bits. Great artist, great guitarist, not necessarily a massive football fan, but we do want to show appreciation for something that an effort that was put in to actually play their bit in achieving where we are now. So on different levels, but specifically for the Albion, Dan was the guitarist on that record, and we very much appreciate his efforts.
And it was this week. It was this week,
14 years ago, we made number 17 in the charts. This very weekend, I think that for the first time in years, and I haven't listened since, I listened to the chart show. That was stolted. That was horrible. I mean, even now, I'm a knackered old fart. It doesn't matter, but it was horrible listening to it. Until such time as it got to number 17, after that turned off, wasn't interested, headed down to the engine rooms at the bottom of Preston Street. And we had a sort of a quick gig there to celebrate the fact we got into the top 20. Mark McGee, the manager at the time, came along as well. Him and Attila had a good old sort of stand-up ding-dong in German about sort of the two Hamburg clubs as to which ones. Mark obviously was at SV Hamburg. Attila's as a St. Pauli fan, and so on. And it was a great night. Lots of beer, lots of singing. Lots of renditions of that sort of awful version of the song, but it was brilliant stuff and a great time. So yes, 14 years ago this weekend, we were at number 17 in the charts,
and we've come a long way from there, Steve. I mean, can you remember what the side was 14 years ago?
Oh my goodness,
I haven't actually looked into this.
So what year would that be?
That would be 04-05. That's the year we survived.
I was going to say probably one of the best achievements actually on the pitch, staying up in the Championship with Dean.
Yes,
up there with staying in the Premier League at the Amex.
So CKR, would it be that era? Virgo would have probably been playing in every single position apart from centre-half.
So this would have been the Ipswich game at home and the last game of the season.
That's the one, yeah. And I think that was also the time
Darren Curry as well, though.
Yeah, so it was also the time of, I think, the Spurs game, wasn't it? The Spurs game in the Cup.
Richard Carpenter.
Yes, it was. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So it would have been Oatway as well, wouldn't it?
Kerry.
I think we played your favourite formation. We played 5-3-2 that day.
Did we?
Yeah. Yeah, we're three centre backs.
That's news to me because that's not my favourite formation.
You're always telling me we should be playing three at the back.
You just said five at the back.
A three is a five, isn't it? Because you've got two wing backs, haven't you?
Of course, Darren Curry had a good weekend last weekend.
He did.
And at all places where his uncle was a legend.
Yeah, he was there, wasn't he? I think they were both there. Obviously, both there. But yeah. I think they were both
Don't
there.
Don't do that again, son.
They went out for a Chinese afterwards.
But, very good.
Okay. Now, it's the silly season, Brian. The transfer window is well and truly in swing at the moment. Now, obviously, with what you do, now there's so many rumours that get thrown around. And I mean, are you duty bound to actually look into everyone just to see if there's any fact in any of these?
Probably not every single one. And you're talking like in January, I don't have too much to do with it because obviously I've got various duties around the sports desk. Andy's like your old-fashioned, how you'd imagine the club correspondent to be. Mm. And in January, he doesn't take a lot of holiday, whereas in the summer, obviously, he might be away for 2 or 3 weeks. So, no, I don't have an awful lot. I had to check a couple this week, which came to nothing. It's mainly been under-23s, hasn't it? And loans, there was the McAllister from Argentina. There's obviously something in that. But, yeah, we check. You sort of know, it depends where it comes from, and you sort of have a feel for it. Sometimes you're surprised actually, there's something in that, and if you get it from somebody who you know, a proper contact, then you know you think yes, there's something in this, and then we run our checks, and I normally just tell Andy and he checks in January because he's around the whole month, it can be a bit annoying, but it's part of the job, and you know, you never know what you're going to stumble across.
Usually when you see these rumours, it's just usually the players' agents trying to drum up some interest in their player, isn't it?
I think there's all sorts of but that is one of the things which can happen. I mean, they say it's a hard, I was thinking the January window, in fact, it's always been like two windows, one right at the start of the month and one right at the end of the month, and in between is not maybe a huge amount, and people say it's a hard window and you don't get the signings. But when I look back, Kyle, Knockhart, Joa twice, LaCardia. You don't get the quantity. Brighton have got a little track record of coming up with one good signing in January.
Do you? I mean, Chris Hughton, I think, has sort of like stated that the January transfer window is not something that is going to be sort of massively busy. And now, like I say, you've got the players going out, especially the under-23s, to get their experience. But I mean, are you getting sort of, irrespective of all the whispers that are coming in, are you getting anything from the club that say, you know, as to not necessarily who they're after, but that they're after anyone at all?
No, not really. We get sort of what you hear, very guarded. I mean, any club, I'm not just saying Brighton, I think any club is particularly guarded about what they're up to. It wouldn't surprise me if one came in. But I don't see, I mean, we were talking before we came on air, I don't see a glaring gap in the current squad for the rest of the season they must fill. But it's that general thing of they must keep progressing, they must keep looking. They've signed players who, I think people like Shane Duffy may be an example, maybe Knockhart when he came in, you weren't thinking they desperately need a centre-back, or desperately need a... From the top of my head, I'm thinking of those as examples. But it's better than what they've got. Looking forwards, is there, the next Murray or the next Bruno out there?
I mean, obviously, that's looking at players coming this way. But, I mean, obviously, there must be interest in our players as well. I mean, and particularly those who may not necessarily... who are not out of favour, but not playing as much as they...
Pascal maybe. Gross to Liverpool, anyone?
That's what I was thinking. But.
Or to his mate in Southampton. Yeah. Well, there's Scalotto and Zoutner, isn't there, who we think are probably...
Is that how you pronounce it?
What, Zoutner? Yes. We had a German sort of work experience at the start of last season. He was telling us about Marcus Zoutner, Uwe Hoeneß-Meyer, Pascal Wurs. some of them, you can get away with some of them. It sounds a little bit silly, but speaking in English, but... Yeah, so those two are the obvious. There was a loan link, wasn't there? Scalotto to QPR, but I'm not sure that's how true that is.
Well, he had the option of going in the summer, didn't he? But for some reason, it was going back to Portugal, I think, wasn't it?
I'm not sure what options he had. I mean, it didn't look like he was going to be in the 25, but then there was gap to put him in the 25. Mm. So I thought they might as well. But he's just not played, has he? I mean, I think Zoutner has played in friendlies and different under-23s and things, so that's a strange one. But I don't know, I can think of one maybe who you wonder if he's a little bit unsettled and not totally happy, but that's just me thinking of things. But
Well, you see, I mean, on Instagram, you see Scalotto, he's always posting pictures around the town, around the city. He seems to be happy enough. Yeah. Happy enough being here. Obviously not happy playing, you know, not playing. But, it's... And I think he knows that he's actually got a fight now that we've got Montoya in. And Bruno, who... Well, bearing in mind that Glenn Murray has got a contract with the end of the season... No, sorry, the end of next season. And I believe that Bruno's is only to the end of this season. Mm. And we haven't heard any whisper about whether he's going to sign another year, by which time that will put him at somewhere around 60, I think. I'm just wondering if this is going to be Bruno's last year.
Yeah, I'm wondering the same. What we don't know, obviously, is if there's any clause there that he's played to play a certain amount of matches. But when he's playing, I think he's been fine. I hope he's not been thinking about being judged in the present on what he might be in the future, if that makes sense. Mm. No, but, I mean, he played in those three consecutive clean sheets, didn't he? Came back into the side. Again, maybe...
But we were saying on this show at the time that Bruno was instrumental to that, because even though he might not necessarily have the legs that he used to, but he's got the organisational nous, and you actually see him on the pitch moving the players around and telling them where to go and stuff, and that was instrumental in that run, I think.
One of the things I think is maybe not valued as much, but that he does really well, is like defending as sort of third centre back when the ball's coming in from the other side. I was watching some highlights of games last night. Remember that little intervention on Autovic at home to West Ham when he nicked the ball off his toe, and then you see like Montoya being out-jumped at Man City at the far post, or the first Cardiff goal when that cross was deflected and he was caught unawares. But he's learning. I mean, he's obviously a very tidy, very proficient footballer. Yeah. So I think that's one of the qualities of Bruno that perhaps we don't look at.
You speak to Bruno quite a lot, don't you? Because of particularly with your bilingual.
Not so much now because he hasn't been playing so much. But I do. Yeah, I have over the years.
But I mean, you've seen his importance around the place and how important Bruno is actually to the whole football club. I mean, with the issues that Anti Knockout's had, for instance, he's been very, very vocal in saying just how much Bruno has helped him.
Yeah, well, they've said, haven't they? They see a job for a role for him here when he's hung
they
up
do.
His boots. Similar. Well, what happened was he got the Inspiration Award last season at the end of the season, and on that video, Paul Barber said he's one of those sort of people we would like to have around the club for a long time when he's hung up his boots. And so I actually asked Paul Barber after, you know, you don't just say that for, you know, without meaning something. And that was when the story came out about this whole boot room ethos that he was keen to. So it started with him saying that he wanted to keep Bruno at the club, the club would like Bruno to stay around the club even when he's finished playing. And then when I asked further, he said about Rossini, about Steve Sidwell, people like that. And obviously that has already come to... But he said, we're not in any rush to retire them. Yeah, play as long as you can.
Again, those people, they're positive influences around the place. And, you know, there was a wonderful interview with Liam on the radio recently, which was just... It was just, like, so positive about Chris Hughton, about the club.
He's just a great interview subject anyway. Sidwell... I mean, it was actually... I keep going back to this. A couple of years ago when we interviewed him, actually, it was Brian that said this to me. He said, my favourite three interview subjects, and I don't know if you still felt this, at the club were Sidwell, Rossini and Bruno. I can't remember the running order, but it was those three. And those three, if they're going to be good interview subjects, then they're going to be positive people around them, you know, to the people around them. And we know what Rossini can do. We know what Sidwell can do. And the fact that Bruno, despite being an old man, is still playing, and yet we can see what he can do. You know, I think that the club should move heaven and earth to keep him here in whatever role that might be.
Actually, there was an interview in another paper. Sorry, Brian, in the Metro yesterday with Adam Elad about how well he's doing and how he's enjoying life at Wickham. And he was basically saying that he left too soon. He wished he'd stuck it out under because obviously he wasn't getting
game
under. He
demanded more game time, didn't he?
He didn't have a great time at Bristol City, and he should have seen it at the season because obviously Oscar went to the end of the season as well, and he certainly would have played under Sammy. So, but I mean, he was saying as well that he's someone like when he hangs up his boots, he wants to come back to Brighton and he wants to try and get a gig here as well.
Do you know what capacity?
Well, as a coach, but...
Okay, all right.
There's a lot of coaches, obviously, on the staff now through all the age groups, with the academy, even the women. There's a lot of employment opportunities there that probably weren't there, obviously, 10, 15 years ago.
Okay. Do you think one issue that might have a factor. I mean, you obviously know Bruno to some degree, but obviously he is Spanish. He's only been in the UK for 5 years. I don't know whether his wife's Spanish or English. You know, would he ever want to return to Spain rather than, you know, retire in England?
I thought that was going to be a Brexit question. his wife's from Barcelona. They've got two kids. One was just starting school when they came, 4 years old at the time. So incredibly similar to Montoya now. So he walked into his first day at school not understanding anybody. Yeah. And they had a baby daughter, again, the same as Montoya when he came from Valencia. Mm. So they've grown up. They're pretty much almost like English kids now, go on holiday to Spain. Mm. So I think there is a big, a big sort of affinity to Brighton. Yeah, home. Yeah. He said in an interview about 2 or 3 years ago that he's never lived anywhere as long as he's lived in Hove. So I just don't know, but I know the family are settled. I mean, to put it that way, whether that means anything to a footballer's life, I don't know. The boy would be coming up to the age where he changed his school anyway.
My son played against him. My son played for Hollingbury Hawks.
And he
played
Bruno?
Against Bruno's son.
Right.
Bruno's son's a keeper.
Was he in goal?
Well,
I think he plays in goal or centre forward, depending on which manager.
Yeah. He's playing up a year, but he's doing really well. Yeah, he's at Hove River Valley.
So, they have got a strong affinity here. But I know he's about to tell me one time, one of his sort of private, it won't happen now, he's too old. He'd have loved to play in Serie A at some point.
Could still play.
He's had offers maybe follow Calde to India or something. Yeah. Who knows? But
how old was Maldini when he retired? He was about 40 odd, wasn't he?
40, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But there's another person just mentioned him. You know, for all the fact that the Albion alumni that we want to sort of get back and retain. Now it's one thing that we appreciate these players, and you like to think that the club's going to do the right thing and hopefully offer them something here. But I think it's just the fact that the fans like the fact that these people are around. Bruno's around, Rossini's around, Sidwell's around. They actually do represent the best of what the club can offer, and we've got to throw in Calder at that as well. Now he's just turned 37, playing in India, which means probably he could carry on doing that till he's 40, given the quality that's there. But having said that, I mean, I was working on the assumption that Calder was very much Brighton based, and he's not. He was keen to return to the Basque country. So yeah, I imagine the lure of the homeland is actually very, very strong, and it depends, like you say. But the point is that Calde, and he said it, that his son's first words were football and Brighton.
Of course they were.
Absolutely, and I think that the youngest one was born here. So they, effectively, they are English, of Spanish parents, but they are English. So, it would be nice to see these guys back, but if not, then at least they should be under no illusions that they were loved and appreciated here.
Okay. Well, it feels like it's a big game today, doesn't it? I mean, we've got Liverpool visiting the Amex today. First time league leaders come to the Amex.
Yeah, first time the league leaders have come to Brighton since my first game at Goldstone Ground, which was also Liverpool.
Really?
82-83. In terms of league leaders, the actual.
Because I mean, City last year was the first game of the season. So.
You probably didn't see it then. We did a piece this week that I managed to dig up and check with Tim Carter. There was that one. They came as leaders, Liverpool, towards the end of 82-83. Went 2-0 up, and then Ian Rush scored.
Was that the 3-3?
It's 2-2.
2-2.
Well, it was 2-0. Gary Howlett scored. Ian Rush pulled one back, and that was the time when you knew that if Ian Rush scored, Liverpool didn't lose. Mm. Finished 2-2. And the other one was Aston Villa came. They were a point clear a couple of years before. Brighton beat them, but they were top of the league when they came. Other seasons, like the eventual champions, have not been top when they've come. So this is the third time that the league leaders have come.
That's an incredible stat, actually. And I've obviously missed out on this because you two don't seem to be surprised at this. So it's something I missed out on during the week, obviously. But that is quite a stat, considering.
I read his work.
Yeah, I was slightly disappointed. I was hoping it was going to be the first time, but it's the third. So it's not bad. It's not bad because there was like seasons where Ipswich would be setting the pace. I mean, there was one season when Liverpool came and they were eighth and Brighton was seventh. But Liverpool ended up winning the league. But they weren't top when they came.
But they always used to end up winning the league back then.
It's pretty monumental.
People are saying it's a free hit. It's the pressure's off. I don't look at it that way.
What way do you look at it then?
I'm looking at it as a winnable game at the moment.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, just because they lost to Man City and then didn't turn up against Wolves.
No, I'm looking at it in the fact that we very nearly got a point up there. They've got injury problems themselves. I mean, we know what they can do to us. We know quite likely to go 2-3-4.
Jamie Greed, know your job.
Yeah, absolutely. But if you know, I was looking at those. We were looking at those odds earlier. But you know, because of our prowess at set pieces at the moment, I can if we could go 1-0 up in that game, we are quite capable of hanging on to that.
I think that's critical to me. If you look at what we did against City and Spurs, where we just backed off them and invited them onto us, yeah, and eventually went 1-0 down.
And it's always a mistake that we present them a goal as well.
Exactly, yeah. So if we do the opposite and get on the front foot early, I think if we score, they'll feel under massive pressure. Well, and I think that could only be a good thing.
Well, yeah, I suppose there is that. I mean, we have improved and like I say, but when Liverpool feel like turning it on, they really feel like turning.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, we know what we're up against. We know we're up against a very, very, very good team with very, very good players. But you know what? If you go into a game thinking you're going to lose, you're going to lose.
Well, yes, I get that, but it's not. It's a case of I think they go into the game with a view of not losing, but you know full well that you have to sort of strive so hard and so fast to do this for 90 minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, don't get me wrong, second half against Liverpool, yes, we played a lot better. And in talking to Liverpool fans, and I'm a sort of semi-regular on the Anfield Wrap, which is kind of the Liverpool equivalent of the Liverpool podcast, you know, their attitude to it was that they didn't play as well as they could have done and Brighton did a job on them. But you can't expect Liverpool to do that sort of so often. Yeah, you have the little wobbles, and if they're going to have a wobble, then it's great that it's now. But even a Liverpool wobble is still going to be hard work for us.
Oh, absolutely. And like, it's going to be a tough game. And then it doesn't get any easier with Man United coming as well, Brian.
No, and also, I think players, the people actually doing the job out there, I don't think there's such a thing as a free hit exists when you're playing in front, you're staking your reputation in front of 30,000 people. Mm. So, like you say, I mean, you've got different scenarios there. I've probably got both scenarios in my head that could happen. But I sometimes think Brighton are at their most dangerous when they desperately need a result. And they're probably not in that situation at the moment. But yeah, that'd be interesting.
The other side of that is we're unbeaten in four games. And every one of those four games has been against the side above us in the league.
And they possibly should have got more points
out
of those games.
We're in good form. Yeah, exactly.
So let's play with no fear.
But talking of which, I mean, we were looking at this on the train earlier and today. Not that either of us are particularly betting people, but AD did sort of like fish out some odds. And if you really wanted a doozy, I know it changed when you were doing it, but we looked at it. David Pruepa to score the first goal and us to win 1-0, 1,700-1.
No, it wasn't. That was
who was that one then?
That was Martin Montoya.
That was Montoya.
Right, okay.
I think
it was
700-1.
It was 700-1. But it was 450-1 for us to win 1-0 when Shane Duffy to score. That's good odds.
That's good odds.
Nearly signed for him. Yeah. Brendan Rodgers on the phone, so that'd be a little story. The one that got away.
But that's it, though. That is all we've got time for this week. So, of course, thank you to my guests. Thank you to Steve Agass. Thank you to Brian Owen. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Pack.
And we're going to rewind 14 years now.
I mean, we could only finish with this. And this was a number 17 in the charts 14 years ago. This is Seagull Scar. Dragged on.